Draper City Talk is a podcast produced by the municipal government of Draper City, Utah, where we discuss local government services and issues and the community at large. Hello, Draper City. Mayor Troy Walker back with you again today on our Draper City Talk podcast. I'm excited for today because we have a really great guest. Mr. Cameron Deal from the Utah League of Cities and Towns is with us, and he is an awesome guy, and he's involved in all the things that we care about as a city. So it'll be a great discussion with Cameron today. We're going to get you some information that you need to have about how our legislature works with respect to cities and zoning authority. And we're also going to talk about something I know you're all interested in. That's the gravel pits and how those things are being handled. Anyway, I want to thank Linda Peterson. Linda, say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Linda is our communications director at Draper City, and she makes this podcast possible. So we're very glad to have her. All right, Cameron, I've introduced you a little bit. Give us a little quick background on yourself. You know, where you're from, what you do, where you went to school, and how you ended up being the executive director of Utah League of Cities and Towns.
Perfect. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Linda, for having me. Whenever I get asked that question, I just chuckle a little bit because my life flashes before my eyes. The League of Cities and Towns exists to advocate for cities at the Capitol and provide resources and training for mayors and council members across the state. We're governed by a board of directors. This you know because you sit on that board.
Yes.
And you are currently the first vice president, which means come September, you'll be the president and the head honcho of the league. And you're joined by 20 other mayors and council members on that board. Previously, other Draper elected officials have served on the board, including one of your current council members, Councilmember Tasha Lowry, previously served on the league board. So you're elected by your colleagues to represent them, and then I work for you and represent you, and we have a staff of about 11 full-time folks and a couple of other contracts who work year-round to advocate for cities.
So
the reason I say my life flashes before my eyes is because I've been here a long time.
You have. So the way this works, just so folks know, is every city that's a member of the league mm-hmm. pays a membership fee.
That's right.
Based upon population size. And is that the criteria?
Basically.
Yeah. So some cities pay more if they're bigger, but we all pay. And we pay into this organization because we know, all of us cities, that the advocacy that it takes in a legislative session, because in Utah, thankfully, we only have a 45-day session. I can only imagine if it was longer.
Right.
But that's a two-edged sword. 45 days is a lot of is not very much time, and then some days it's way too much time, depending on what the issue is. But they passed some 590 bills last year in this last session.
Yeah, right? 591, but who's counting?
And that was a record.
It was a record. They beat their record from last year, which was 574.
And so, as folks know, we have a lot of issues as cities. Primarily, I just want to clarify that, but Cam, tell us a little bit about your educational background and kind of your experience.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I grew up in Murray, but my love of local government goes actually back a couple of generations because my grandfather had been a mayor of a small town in Idaho, Glens Ferry, Idaho, for six terms. And then
six? Wow.
Six, yeah. I don't recommend it for your sanity, but he was the mayor for six terms, and then he was on the city council for two terms before that. But what I took away from his community service was that he and my grandmother loved their town. And then on my dad's side of the family, he grew up here in Utah, but his parents were very active in local politics, and then my parents were very active in local government in Murray, where I grew up. And what I love about working for the league is being able to work with mayors and council members who really are in this for public service. They care about their communities. Each community is unique. Each community has a proud history. And my job is to help you as a mayor have the tools you need to govern your community and to work with you and your fellow mayors to help the region as a whole. We often say we want you to think regionally as you act locally, because ultimately the decisions you're making as a mayor will make a difference for generations to come. So I started the league in 06 as a legislative intern and went to the University of Utah from undergrad, went to law school, and now I'm in my seventh year as the league director and just finished my 16th legislative session with the league.
Yeah, so folks, Cameron, he's a very bright young man, and he does a very good job. Cameron and his whole staff taking care of our advocacy needs at the Capitol. And it's amazing to watch him work. He's got some young folks working with him. Cameron's a young guy. They got a lot of energy. They, when you ask them to get some data or put something together, like a year or so ago, we needed data on how many entitled units there were in, you know, sort of statewide and in the main metropolitan counties, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, Utah. And it wasn't about a week, and we had this amazing data that we could show. And frankly, we know it's effective because the legislators this year were quoting our data.
That's
so
right.
That's one of the other great benefits of being a member of the league, is that we can get information that helps all of us with the legislature, you know, quickly and clearly, and it's well written. And you know, so they do a great job. So Cam, we're glad to have you. And I know Cam works hard like all of us do. During the session, though, it's a little bit more of a different level of insane, because you know, the legislature can stay as long as they want every night. And some nights they stay late, some nights they get off early. But when they're in session, their Cameron's little girls have a chain that they paper chain, and they count down to when Dad will be able to spend some time with them. So we know
that's
tough. But
that's okay. Right. Our whole staff kiss our families goodbye for the 2 months that the legislature's in session.
Yeah, and during a session, if you get a text or you know, if you see a missed call from Cameron or one of the staff as mayors or members of the board, we're always in communication. I feel like I spent a lot of time this year there, and I didn't spend nearly as much as you did. But anyway. So yeah, the league is amazing. I'm going to be the president next year of the league, so that'll be interesting, exciting. I look forward to it. Of course, I love Draper City. I love doing the job as mayor, and this is a way to sort of enhance our ability to affect, you know, our lives locally with respect to state legislatures. So let's talk. We know we've gotten over what the purpose of the league is. Let's get right to the 2024 legislative session. And there's three things I want to go over with you. Number one, let's talk a little bit about land use authority. Land use authority is the ability for a city to zone and create the community that it wants. And I want to talk about land use authority in the context of the legislature's view of solving what we all know is a housing crisis. We hear that phrase. Housing crisis. We know there's two things we know about housing. There's not enough of it in Utah, and it's really, really expensive. And so let's talk about that first. Maybe give us your perspective on the legislature's view on how we're going to get out of this housing crisis. Because it is interesting that you know, in a small government, Republican sort of run state, that the first solutions we're looking for this are government solutions. So, you know, anyway, Cameron, go ahead and give us kind of your perspective on that.
Well, thank you, Maren. You've been in office long enough to know that the challenges we face today about the lack of supply and the expense of housing really have their roots in the Great Recession. If you go back to the Great Recession over a decade ago now, the construction industry was hit extremely hard.
You're talking 2008.
Yep, 2008.
The Great Crash.
Yep, the Great Crash. And so Utah's known for having lots of kids. Utah's known for a great quality of life. People want to live here. So as our population was still growing, even during the Great Recession, you also saw the production of new housing at a standstill. So inevitably what happens is you create this gap in the number of housing units that are being produced versus the number of households and families that are looking for new housing.
I always say that the housing crisis starts in the master bedroom.
There you go. Yep.
And I know that some people, that's controversial, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have four, so I've contributed four kids. Love all of them. You know, we all love our kids. I think the family size is fantastic. But we do need to realize we're making the kids, that we need places for them to live. So
that's exactly right. Yeah. Well, and even here in Draper City, Draper looks a lot different today than when I was a kid growing up in Murray. When I was a kid growing up in Murray, we'd come to Draper for VF Factory Outlet.
That's right. Yes.
And we'd have hamburgers at Neil's. So,
did you ever go to Raging Waters? Are you too young for that?
Are you talking the original Raging Waters?
Out there on the point, the freezing cold water park that was out at the point?
Yes. Going way back when, yes. Okay. Right. So my point is, change is inevitable when you have a desirable place to be. Draper, just like the entire Wasatch Front, the state of Utah, is a very desirable place to be. So people want to live here. And we had several years where there just was not housing being created.
Coming out of the recession, nobody's building anything.
That's right.
Trying to recover. But the kids are still making here.
Okay. The kids are still looking. Then you add COVID on top of that, and you see the migration coming from other states, and you have all of these pieces of the formula coming together to really exacerbate the housing crisis. Now, we do have some positive news and some positive signs here.
And in COVID, we put $1 trillion in the U.S. economy to keep everyone going, which caused the value of money to decline and interest rates to increase.
True. Yep. And then you saw an exodus of people from coastal areas coming to places like Idaho and Utah and elsewhere. Okay. So those are all your macro pieces. And then you have all of the economic pieces you started to reference around financing. Cities don't control interest rates. Cities don't control the labor shortage that we're facing. The construction industry still has not fully recovered from the Great Recession in terms of number of people in the construction industry.
So the number of people building stuff is still below what it was
per capita, per-recession. Yeah, per capita.
Wow.
But think how much we've been building in Utah anyway. So the competition there is
hard to believe. Yeah,
the competition there is big. Then you have supply chain challenges and the cost of materials. All of these pieces come together, and it really is the perfect storm. And unfortunately, it's the perfect storm that has really taken or had the biggest impact on millennials and people who are just trying to get into the housing market. So with that being said, we do have some good things to tell in Utah. We had, prior to the escalation in interest rates, we had a three-year window where we were building more housing units. The private sector was building more housing units than there were new households. So we were actually cutting into that gap. We actually closed that gap by about 50% that dated back to the recession.
Since you brought up the word the gap, so when you hear the governor talk or somebody talk about the housing crisis, and that it's usually about the number of homes that are available, or number of units.
Yep.
Could be apartments, could be condos, could be single family detached houses. What's the gap?
Yeah, so the gap is the number of the housing units that are available compared to the number of households that exist.
And what is our actual gap as far as you know?
Well, we are recording this in March of 2024.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because when we first did the gap analysis about 5 years ago, the gap was approximately 56,000 units. Prior to the increase in interest rates, so this number would be around 2022, that gap had been cut approximately in half. So okay, that was so the positive.
So we were at 56,000 needed.
Yep, and that was cut in half.
Cut in half to 20.
Yep, and then when interest rates went up, you started seeing construction slow down.
Gap gets bigger.
And the gap's gotten bigger. So the estimate as of March of 2024 is we've gone from 28 back up to about 37 because, and you look at the year 2023, we had fewer new housing units built than households created. Now, this gets to the key question of who's responsible for what. And you had the quip earlier about government solutions to this type of problem, especially when so many of the inputs into this problem are market-based.
Right. I mean, you've hit the biggest ones. One, how many people are building homes, the interest rate to borrow money for construction loans and for people to buy homes, and then getting lumber, steel, electrical, plumbers, framers.
Yep.
And then, of course, the land value. Because in Draper, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on which end of the stick you're on, land values are astronomical.
And I'm glad you emphasize that, depending on what end of the stick you're on, because this is where the city does start to play a role.
Right.
Is in a desirable place like Draper, land costs are more expensive. And so you're already working from behind if you're trying to produce housing that's affordable to a certain type of price point because of those land costs. So we often say cities plan for housing, but we don't build housing. So we as a league, and you've been an instrumental part of this over the last few years, have said we are willing to figure out how can we plan more efficiently? How can we plan better looking out to the future, recognizing that ultimately, the builders are the ones who actually have to build the units, but what can we do to plan in a way that preserves the quality of life for today's residents, but also plans for the needs of tomorrow's residents?
Excellent. I want to not leave this. Well, I got it in my head. I want to say it's from Ryan Mew that we know the gap's around 36,000 today. How many units do we have entitled? That's the next question.
Yeah, this is another great point. Yes. As you brought up the data earlier, we spent a lot of time last summer trying to understand this piece. because when I would meet with your colleagues, I would hear from city after city, we have entitled X number of units. Now, what that means is,
that's right.
Explain what that means is that your city council has said, we have the infrastructure, or we're planning for the infrastructure to accommodate these 300 new units on this current empty field, but nothing's being built yet.
And it's a little deeper than that from a legal perspective. The developer, the property owner, has got the zoning they've asked
that's
for.
Right. Yep.
If they decided they wanted to do a development agreement as opposed to just use our zoning, they've got a development agreement that's specific. Everyone knows what's going to go on this entitled property. Mm-hmm. It's the most valuable property you can have is property that's entitled.
Right.
If you're looking to build houses or things like that. Right.
Right. So I'll use that example. I was just saying, you have an empty field where historically it's been agricultural. Only a couple of units are on that whole empty field. The city has rezoned it to allow for 300 units to be on this empty field.
Now, this is a hypothetical.
This is hypothetical, just pure hypothetical. So those 300 units will, in perpetuity, require city services. They'll require roads. They'll require sidewalks. They'll require water. They'll require sewer. They'll require someone to answer the 911 call, regular police and fire protection, parks and recreation, and all of the services that cities provide. So once the city says, we are going to rezone this from agricultural to whatever this residential use is, we are anticipating at some point 300 units, up to 300 units, will get built here. Well, what we found as we were talking to our cities across the state is, in the aggregate, there were over 190,000 units that fit into that category of units that cities had zoned for, that cities had planned for, but that weren't being built for some reason.
And so this caused a lot of the consternation, because people always say to me, Mayor, why do we have so many apartments? You've let too many apartments come into town. And, you know, we've put apartments and multifamily where it makes sense, because we've had this pressure from a government solution that one of the ways, before we got the data kind of squared away where you knew it was 36,000 we needed, but 190,000 we had available, it was a much different discussion, because the legislature was like, we have this need, you guys, it's your fault, cities, because you're not entitling property. Mm-hmm. If the cities would get out of the way, I'm hearing this all the time, if the cities would get out of the damn way,
right,
all the buildings would be where we want them. And we know that's not true.
Well, and the point I just made about the services cities provide in perpetuity is why you need city involvement.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, once that building unit is built, they are now part of the city in perpetuity.
Right.
So the city has a role to play. Now,
when we look at the gap, so we got our gap between 100, and we have 190 entitled. Mm-hmm. And so that became a good element for discussion with legislators, because I think it really sort of brought the conversation around to, okay, this really is not all cities' faults, right?
Right. I mean, right.
Look, there are some bad actor cities that won't allow any density, that have said we won't have any apartments in our city. And unfortunately, when one city does it, it reflects poorly on all the rest mm-hmm. of us. And sometimes, oftentimes, the legislature will legislate on an anecdotal issue in one locality. Mm-hmm. Like a city council says, we will never approve an apartment in this city. That gets back to
it. Does. It does.
So even though you have
and that's
a gap
part of why
have,
we exist, right?
It's exactly
to say that's
right.
One
yeah.
city. Let's talk about the big picture before we pass legislation.
So we have 36,000 we need. We have 190 available. So as the government, our state legislature, as it looks to how to solve this problem, let's kind of talk about how that data has massaged us into where we're going.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the key questions we always ask at the Capitol is, what's the problem a potential bill is trying to solve? And what we did over the last year, and you were part of this at the league board level, is we said, in the housing and land use space, what are the key outcomes that we want?
And this takes me to the ADU bill.
Well, do you want to hit that first, or do you want me to?
Yeah, hit that first, because that's an example of, this is a bill trying to solve a problem, mm-hmm. and then get to the end of the row where it really didn't solve any problems.
Sure.
So go ahead.
Sure. So let's take a step back then, because again, the roots of this challenge we're facing as a community go back 16 years.
Right.
And you wanted to talk about 2024, but I think, and what happened this past session, but I think it is important to recognize how much has happened in the last few years.
And that's excellent perspective, because that's a really good, okay, keep going.
So in 2021, during that legislative session, the legislature passed a couple of bills that were not really in the partnership space. They were more in the conflict space, where the state was trying to step in and dictate to local governments, thou shalt plan this way.
Right.
And more importantly, you can't do these things, local governments, or you have to do these things, local governments. And those were around certain design standards, and then they were also around accessory dwelling units, particularly internal accessory dwelling units.
Yeah, they took away our ability as a city to regulate the look of a building in a residential setting.
To a degree. Yeah. And we were heavily involved in those negotiations. And one of the key lessons I took away from that whole experience was we collectively as cities needed to do a better job year-round of articulating what cities were already doing, and then figure out areas where we could be viewed as part of the solution and not just viewed as the problem. So with internal ADUs, essentially the mother-in-law apartments, you mentioned the anecdotes. Well, there were several cities around the state that just were refusing to allow mother-in-law apartments.
Of any kind.
Yeah. Yep. So they were refusing to allow mother-in-law apartments. And when you think about from a planning perspective, it's cheaper to have a mother-in-law apartment as part of an existing unit than it is to build a brand new house. So legislators were saying, why is it that you have cities saying no to allowing someone to use a basement for a basement apartment, which could get a young family started in there, and a lot of these exist anyway, even if the city was saying no. And there was a lot of frustration feeling like cities were an obstacle to progress here, even though we could demonstrate that the majority of cities were allowing mother-in-law apartments.
That's right.
It was the handful of cities that weren't allowing mother-in-law apartments that then spurred that discussion of the legislature needing to step in. And so we all spent a lot of time negotiating that bill, and there were still some exceptions we were able to keep in there because there are certain places where maybe you don't have the infrastructure in place, or you have some building code issues that you need to meet from a health safety perspective before you have a mother-in-law apartment. But ultimately, what prior to that bill would have been a decision left at the city council level was made at the state level with some exceptions. So in fact, you and I had lunch shortly thereafter, as you recall, and yep. where we just said, we never want to go through that type of experience again.
Right.
Well, that led to a lot of dialogue that off season about how do we respect that when there's state legislation, it's usually one size misfits all. It's responding
well to said.
This anecdote, yes. But it's treating Draper the exact same as it's treating Ogden, and those are two totally different communities.
And I remember in the negotiations of this ADU, Auxiliary Dwelling Unit bill, that there were some numbers that were given out that this was going to fix and close the gap a specific amount. Mm-hmm. And did it do it?
It's still to be determined.
Right.
And the reason I say that
is...
Yeah, it didn't immediately, but we're starting to see data sets coming back because individuals who will license their internal ADU, now for the first time we've got that data set in existing areas, and you're seeing more new housing units built with IADUs, which over time I think provides an additional opportunity for a home buyer to purchase a home maybe they couldn't otherwise afford, but they can now because they can rent out the basement. So, I think the answer is still to be determined, but the process was a tough process.
Yes. Okay.
And so that was 2021, and you and I have scars to show about how that went down. Well, that led to the 2022 session, and you mentioned stationary plans a moment ago. The main focus of the 2022 legislature was stationary plans, but I think we found a magic recipe here. With what a stationary plan is this. The state said cities who have fixed rail, you've got a front runner station, you've got tracks, or you've got certain types of bus rapid transit, we are going to expect more of you as you plan around those fixed rail stations. But we're going to stop short of dictating the exact outcome in all the different locations. What we saw in other states, California being the most prominent, but there are quite a few other states who've done this, where the legislatures have simply stepped in and said, cities, thou shalt allow X number of residential units around within a half mile of your transit station, period, end of story. Problem solved, I was just kind of washing my hands of it, though you can't see that in the podcast.
Yep.
Instead, the argument we made at the Capitol was that the track station at Salt Lake City International Airport is fundamentally different than the track station in Draper. And they should be planned differently. And you have existing land uses that need to be taken into account. You have a geography that's drastically different. But the Draper and Salt Lake both acknowledge, yes, we have this great asset, and we should plan higher intensity land use around it to create a sense of community. So ultimately, the state sets some objectives around housing and around open space and around access to opportunity and transportation connectivity. The state said, these are the objectives. Draper, figure out what that looks like in Draper.
We're in the process right now of coming up with our stationary plan. We've had some public input, but we're going kind of, we're still in the drawing board process. But let's talk about it a little bit, because in addition to the state, you know, you said that nicely, they set some objectives. But what happens to a city if they don't do the stationary plan? If you had a city said, we're not going to do it, or we're just not going to do it.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen. We have until 2025 for cities to do the stationary plans. But if a city does not comply with that requirement, then the city jeopardizes access to state transportation funds.
Yeah, so let me translate that for the public. That's BNC road funds.
It's not.
No,
it's not.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just the state dollars
Be
spent Draper, but it's not the local BNC money. That was kept separate. That was one of the big pieces in the negotiations.
They had that in there, so that's much where I've got it. Okay,
so. Well, yeah, that's where it started, and we ultimately pushed back. Again, this is the value of the league of saying,
right.
These
right.
BNC funds that cities rely on for road maintenance, we're going to fight tooth and nail to preserve the ability to invest those dollars. But if the state is weighing between a state investment in Draper
right.
and in Cameron City, and Draper has done a stationary plan and meets all the requirements, and you've done it in the way that makes sense for Draper, but Cameron City says pound sand, well, then the state should spend their state transportation dollars in Draper. They shouldn't spend it in Cameron City.
Okay, so as we look at it, there's and that's valuable for a couple of reasons, specifically for our community, because we have the Point, which is about to become, you know, a mixed use, hopefully high tech employment center. It'll have obviously a fair amount of housing as well, but we've got a new station, a new front runner station coming. We need money for a station. We need money for light rail to come out of the Point south mm-hmm. into Utah County. So when we look as a city we are a candidate, I guess is what I'm saying, for a lot of future state infrastructure investment. So our incentive, if we want a well-planned city and if we want to reap the benefits of the Point as mm-hmm. as it will come up, we've got to be in compliance with this stationary plan business and make it work.
That's right. But you have the flexibility to figure out what it looks like, because the Point is a different challenge and a different opportunity
yes.
in Draper than downtown.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that was the key principle for us, was we all agreed that we should maximize the planning opportunities around transit, but we needed to have the flexibility at the local level to figure out what makes sense where.
So as we do our plan, we're gonna come up with density. And of course, the density is gonna be more than a lot of people want, not as much as some are gonna want. Somewhere in the middle, we're gonna hit a density level that the project will work. And so folks, as you see us planning and doing our stationary plan, we're not just doing that, we're not just trying to create density around our track stations for fun. We're required to do it.
That's true. And there was a robust public process that's also required in the bill, because we as a league wanted to make sure that local government, which is the government most accessible to the people, and it's really the neighborhood level of government, we wanted to make sure that neighbors still had a chance to weigh in on the future of their community.
Well, let's go back to your comment on California, because I think it's important for people to understand. We always, I've heard many legislators, I've heard other elected officials, I've said it, we don't want to be California.
Yeah. Amen.
But I'm telling you, Cameron, we look a lot like California.
And well, I hope not, but
we have a lot of stuff that California has tried.
Mm-hmm.
ADUs came mm-hmm. out of California.
Right.
This X amount of units per acre, hands washed, this is how many you're going to have.
Yep.
That comes out of California.
It did. And legislators were more responsive to our arguments than they were about those blanket mandates. So I agree with you that some of these bad ideas start in California, they start in other states around the country. And it's really the states that have a lot of economic growth are facing the same challenges we're facing. How do you plan the transportation needs? How do you have enough water? How do you plan for housing? And from a city perspective, we plan and we don't, you know, we build infrastructure, but we don't build the actual housing units. And when I talk to state league directors around the country, what I'm constantly amazed by is the conflicts they're having with their legislatures, because the legislature is coming with just the top-down approach. And so thou shalt do this. And then some of our legislators will hear those ideas and say, well, if it's working there, then let's do it here.
Right, right.
But thankfully, we've had enough legislators who've said, no, we agree with cities that there should be local flexibility. And cities agree with the state that we all want to maximize the point, or we want to have the quality of
life
we enjoy.
Transit so assets, front-runner stops,
that's
track
right.
stops.
So how do we get there? And how do we do it in a way that's not the California approach?
And the good news about that, too, is although you'll hear as a legislator or two say, yeah, it's working here, it's working in California. The good news, like you said, is, and we're fortunate because Governor Cox is a person who I believe always is trying to make a Utah solution that fits mm-hmm. our community different. I've loved his approach to housing, especially this last session. Yep. He appointed a person that was former legislator, Steve Waldrop, who is the sort of his housing czar. So he's got someone focused entirely on what can, you know, the state solution to this problem. And the governor acknowledges all these mm-hmm. other things. And so as we've talked about affordable housing, I think we've got a lot of apartments. And what the governor would like to see, and I think a lot of our legislative leadership, President Adams in the Senate, Speaker Schultz in the House, they think that home ownership and the future of the ability to, you know, build wealth and own something is really a key to the American dream. And so I like our approach to trying this year. Maybe that transitions into this year.
Well, it's perfect because you talked about Steve Waldrop. He used to be in the legislature and was the bill sponsor for the station area plan bill.
Right, right.
And that was a very collaborative process. We did some really hard stuff in that bill, but it was very collaborative. So we were thrilled as an organization when Governor Cox asked Steve to serve in this role, because Steve has that reputation, as is the governor, of trying to come up with the Utah process, the Utah way and solutions.
And you and I, we met with Speaker Schultz at the beginning of the session, and mm-hmm. he said something I thought was really interesting and great, actually. He said, look, we acknowledge that you cities have done a lot to change yep. your paradigms and work with the density and work with the zoning. He said, I think we need to let some of the stuff we've already put in place, because like you say, if you go all the way back mm-hmm. to 2009 as the beginning of this problem, I think we have to let some of these bills we passed in 2021, 22, yep. they've got to have some time. And so Speaker Schultz was great. He said, we're gonna kind of let this stuff we've already put together percolate through and see how it works. He kept his word.
He did.
Which was really good.
Yep.
But let's talk about what we kind of came up with this year with respect to housing specifically.
Well, you mentioned Speaker Schultz and President Adams, and you and your role as an officer within the league get to meet with them on a regular basis, representing all cities, not just Draper. And we had a great meeting with Speaker Schultz where the two of you basically looked at each other and said, well, we fundamentally agree, and the issue you fundamentally agreed on was we wanted more home ownership. So it wasn't just we want more housing units just for the sake of getting to a certain number. And that's where the apartment issue we've seen is, it's been very profitable to build apartments, and we've needed apartments. They play a role. But we all can generally agree that the more owner-occupied units, the more home ownership opportunities that exist, the better off future generations are going to be. And that's something we all agreed on. So once we had agreement that we wanted that outcome, then we could start to work backwards and say, what policy levers are within the sphere of the state or local governments to try to get there? Because ultimately, cities don't really regulate ownership per se. Like we regulate the land use, but not necessarily the ownership of that land.
Right.
So this is a tricky thing for us, right? We constantly say to the legislature, we want you to respect our role as cities. Well, what's our role as cities? Our role is to provide police and fire, and our role is to figure out where the pipes go and the built environment, but not necessarily if the person living inside that new housing unit is an owner or a renter. So that led to some interesting conversations through the session. You were part of these with Steve Waldrop and Speaker Schultz and President Adams and Representative Stephen White and Senator Lincoln Fillmore, who are the co-chairs of the Commission on Housing Affordability, and then Representative Cal Musselman and Senator Wayne Harper. I mean, that was basically our crew that was meeting throughout the session. And to the credit of all of them, and then the other stakeholders in the private sector, like the home builders and the realtors and others, we were really laser focused on home ownership and affordable home ownership. So the types of bills that passed this session focused on saying if a builder is willing to meet certain criteria around ownership and affordability. And if the city meets certain requirements around zoning, if those pieces of the puzzle come together, then the city can use tax increment financing. So basically the growth in property tax, not just from the city, but from other property tax entities, they can use a portion of that growth in property tax to pay for those upfront infrastructure costs to then make that project work. Because this gets that 190,000 number.
Yeah, so I was going to say, get right to that 190, because you might have, maybe you got 20,000 units in this one area, but it's super expensive to get the road.
That's right.
It's super expensive to get the pipe, the sewer, water, power, all of it. And this is a cool part of the, I really like this bill, because it gives this opportunity. So the owner can say, okay, I can, with tax increment financing over time, I can get this stuff here and get these units under construction.
Well, you mentioned 20,000. You've got a neighboring city down the road here that's 30,000 units that have been entitled.
Is that Lehigh?
Saratoga. Yeah, Lehigh's number's big, but it's not quite that big.
So think about 30,000 entitled spots in Saratoga Springs. They could add another 30,000 units.
That's right.
But they can't because?
Infrastructure. So West Jordan's got 9,000 and Harriman's got 12 to 14,000 and South Jordan's got 20 some odd thousand.
I think we had the six numbers, or seven.
Yeah, the numbers are staggering. So we presented that data to Steve Waldrop and to the speaker and the governor and the president and others. And then that led to the question of what is the problem the bills are trying to solve? Well, for a lot of these units, they're stuck right now because of either financing or infrastructure. Okay. So now that we have agreement on the problems we're trying to solve, let's talk about how we tried to solve them. On the financing side, you have a lot of smaller builders that cannot get access to capital right now because of interest rates and other macroeconomic factors that are outside of your control as mayor, right?
Yes.
Residents think you're all powerful. You're not omnipotent when it comes to interest rates, right? Okay. Well, we passed a legislation this year that all of the organizations supported that will provide some short-term state dollars to builders so long as they meet the owner-occupied and affordability requirements. Likewise, there was the bill we were talking about a moment ago. It's called the First Home Investment Zone. There's another one, it's called the Home Opportunity Promotion Zone. Both of those are the tax increment bills where the city could capture some tax increment in the medium term for 15 to 25 years that could help with those upfront costs of infrastructure. But the only way a builder can access those dollars is if that infrastructure meets affordability and owner occupancy requirements. So it's not just tax increment dollars to any sort of building or any sort of housing. It's like, no, these are tax increment dollars with that specific target in mind. And then we also have another bill, House Bill 13 from Representative Jim Dunnigan, that is trying to get to that widespread, wide-scale infrastructure piece, saying that once a city has approved the development, then a builder could create a special service district that could access the public bond markets and bond for that large-scale infrastructure, but then those bonds have to be paid off before the home buyer buys the home.
Yeah, so I really like that bill because it gets to that other. They tell us there's this private money out there in the bond market that wants to finance these short-term investments. So just so we're clear, the developer would have an entitled parcel. He needs the infrastructure. He'd go to this bond market and he would get a loan from the bondholders to build the infrastructure. And then as he gets the development underway, before he sells any houses in the development, he's got to pay back those infrastructure bonds. So it's going to get reflected in the price of the house. But
it does now anyway.
Yep. It's just going to be able to do it now as opposed to the natural flow of when it might happen 10 or 20 years from now.
Yep, that's right.
And that was an excellent bill. I like that one. It was good work.
And that took a year and a half of lots of deliberations. And this is, again, where I think Utah's a little different than other states. Even though we have a very short legislative session, a lot of these bills were talked about for weeks and months leading up to the session. We may not have finalized the language until the last few days, like in Representative Dunnigan's bill, but that bill was going for a year and a half. The tax increment bills, those were a little different. Those bills, the ideas and the language really came together in a matter of weeks.
And the year before last, not this session, but the year before, we passed some down payment assistance, mm-hmm. the legislature did, which, you know, gives people an opportunity to get up to $20,000 mm-hmm. of a match, if you will, or assistance in a down payment on a place. The problem is we got to get some units where a $20,000 down payment is a thing.
Yep.
Because right now, especially in Draper, that's not a thing. But so those were some excellent, you know, bills that we worked on. But I always tell people, this stuff doesn't just happen. It's right. Not like, you know, people think, this is like continuing negotiations. Although the legislature is only in session for 45 days, they have interim sessions. They work on this stuff all the way along, especially the leaders that are tapped to do it. Mm-hmm. So we've got a great speaker, a great Senate president, great governor. We've got great appointed staff like Steve Waldrop. We've got good senators like Harper and Dunnigan and, you know, Cullimore and some of these folks that get, you know, and a lot of times our legislature develop our legislatures, a lot of the leaders are developers and they take a knock on that. Well, you know, it's a developer run legislature. I've said it myself. So, but I do want to say that one of the good things about that is they also understand it. Mm-hmm. They understand development and I think it actually helps. And I think, although they may get some grief for it, or we might give them grief at times and say, well, it seems like you're setting all these bills up just for development. At the same time, we need the houses, we need the things. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that you are working with people that understand really how the money fits and, you know, mm-hmm. how it all fits. I mean, I'm just a lawyer. I'm not a developer, but
right.
I think our legislature, by and large, we've got a good group that are, I think, trying to solve the problem as best they can.
Yeah, and my hope is that the tools that came out of this session, and even the tools like we were talking about, the stationary plans, allows you as a mayor working with your council to work with property owners in your city and work with the neighbors who already live here and say, how do we plan Draper for the next 5, 10, 20 years, and how do we bring all these pieces together?
Okay. Maybe, well, I talked earlier, I said we might get to the talk about gravel. We might need to have Cameron back and just do one on the gravel bills, so just for our community, so we can, because it's kind of complex where we can go through it. But let's just, we've gone over longer, but Cam, I really appreciate how you've explained this. What do you think? Do you think this was a successful session, all things considered, for maybe the people to get a first home? Because, you know, you drive around. I went to Alta High School years and years ago, but in my community, you know, there's in Sandy, there's various levels of housing. Like, it's some that's less expensive than others. I mean, it's smaller homes, and as you move up the east side, you get mm-hmm. bigger, more expensive. In my day as a kid, there was always homes for sale in all those segments. Like, mm-hmm. you could go to the smaller neighborhood and find a place to live. I bought my first house for $129,000 in Sandy.
Rub it in.
Yeah, and I know, and I know this because you just bought a house. Do you want to tell us a little briefly about how painful that was?
Yeah, it was and still is painful. But yeah, we bought a house a few months ago for the first time, and it was fascinating being in the market for a couple of years, watching the home prices go up, watching the interest rates fluctuate, and really on a daily basis, we were recalculating on what we could afford.
Hey, you're ready to go make an offer, and you're like, oh, interest rates are ticked a little.
Yeah, or there was one house we made an offer on. It was 1,700 square foot house, so, you know, by no means a large house,
right.
but certainly sufficient. And we made the offer. The next day, the realtor came back to us and said, if you want to stay in the game, you need to increase your offer by another $100,000.
Another hundred.
$100,000. And we just laughed. Like, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Why didn't you say so? Here's another $100,000 in the couch cushions.
If we had that $100,000, we'd already have a house. Thanks.
Right.
But no, so your experience, because, you know, you and I talked about it. I mean, but sometimes I'll ride my bike through areas of Sandy where I kind of grew up, and there's just no homes for sale in this segment where people can get a start. Like my house that I bought in Sandy for $120,000, I think it was $26,000. Split entry house, you know, a little tiny quarter acre lot. It was wonderful for us. We loved it, but I wish I could find one of those. You know, I mean, that's gone. I mean,
right. The market is stuck.
Yeah. I don't think I could actually afford my current house now if I had to buy it. So,
well, a lot of people can say that too.
I think a lot of people are in that boat. So,
well, and that's why, again, I applaud the governor for saying, let's focus on, he's referred to them as first homes,
right.
That's the term you used,
yep.
But how do we increase the supply of first homes? And he put out a target number of 35,000 over the next 5 years. And that, again, will require a combination of cities planning for a variety of housing types, builders being willing to build a variety of housing types, and build to a variety of price points. And now there are some tools in place to try to bring that together. But it also recognizes that there are a lot of market forces outside of our control. So I'm quite optimistic that the work we've done the last 3 years will have a long-term impact for the better of how we plan for the state.
And that's probably a good spot to end on, that we think we're moving in the right direction. I know when we're in the battle with the legislature, we sometimes get, at least I do, I'll complain and moan and gripe and want to argue, and because I like doing that. But I think by and large, we work pretty good with them. All the personalities, we kind of all know each other. Speaker Schultz and I, we can be pretty frank with each other, and it's nice to be able to be. And
Well, and the residents of Draper are very fortunate to have you, because you've served on the city council side, so you've been in the legislative chair setting the policy. You've been the mayor now. You're one of the longest tenured mayors along the Wasatch Front, and so you've got the respect of your peers at City Hall. We represent about 1,500 mayors and council members across the state. And so you've got that respect from those other mayors and council members, so they know when you say this is important, people listen. And you've got the respect of legislators who will say, yeah, we want to know what city's saying, we want to all be at the table to try to figure out these complicated issues. So when you look at this past legislative session, we had really important discussions around housing and land use, around transportation funding, around water, around gravel pits, and we can talk about more of those later.
Yeah.
But I look at the last 3 years, and that dovetails with your time as involved in league leadership. I feel really good about the collaboration. I feel like we've respected the state role, they've respected our role, and we've been really focused on these quality of life outcomes for today's and tomorrow's residents. So thank you for your service at Draper and to the league.
Well, thank you, Cam. Thank you. And again, thank your staff, for all of them, or Justin, Molly, all your team. They're awesome. They get the work done. So folks, we're really fortunate to have this great League of Cities and Towns that we all belong to, but I truly think it's the best money we spend is in a lobbying, in an advocacy context that there is. I mean, it's just really good. Cam, thanks again for
your
good work and representing not just our community, but communities across, because we're all together. I mean, we all fit in the same valley, and what happens in our city is also happening in other cities, so we're all in it together. But again, thank you. And I think we'll have to have Cam back at some point to talk a little bit about gravel. Sorry, we went long, folks, but this is this is really, it just takes a while to explain this stuff so you can understand what's happening and where we're all trying to go and get. So Linda, thank you.
We'll call this part one, and we'll keep everyone hanging
with
bated breath for Cameron's return.
I intend to do, because the gravel bills, there were two of them, mm-hmm. we'll just say this in the end, that have different objectives, and they're in study, mm-hmm. and what that means is we got to study and we got to negotiate. That's what it means. We were fortunate to get them in negotiation phase. So, but I want to explain to the public, and I'm going to do a town hall, and maybe I'll have you come out, mm-hmm. and we'll just sit there and explain what these bills mean, because gravel pits are tough. Nobody likes them. They make dust. They do all these things that people don't like. They're ugly, but they also provide concrete.
Yeah,
which we need. And so it's a give and take, and it's something that we're all interested in. Anyway, Cameron, thank you again. Yep. Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's the end of Draper Talk for March 2024.
For timely information on city news, events, traffic alerts, and public safety emergencies, you may subscribe to email or text notifications from Draper City by visiting draperutah.gov/notify. Or follow us on social media at Draper City Utah on Facebook and at Draper City on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. This has been Draper City Talk. Please join us again.